my side.
Me too.
Very good. So was it a good Tuesday? Was it a chill out Tuesday?
It was good. Did the dirty 20 and it was fun. So yeah, relaxing.
Good. All right, well, we're just starting with a 100th episode. What are you guys talking about?
What are you guys talking about?
It's right. All right, everybody.
100th. Well, oh, my God, I'd
forgotten.
Yeah,
that's right. That's right. So welcome to the special 100th episode of... What are you guys talking about? I was just talking about this with my other day, with like my day job today, and they're like, 100 episodes on? I'm like, yeah, I know, right? Kind of crept up on us because we were like, oh, the good news was for this 100th episode, we were able to watch Dune, which... you know, if you're going to, like, do one about film, you might as well do one about, like, a really big film like that, right? So we will get into the weeds on Dune today and start, of course, with first impressions in just a few moments. But for those of you joining us for the first time, this is our 100th episode. We are Lovatory Productions. We are a film studio, music video studio, basically anything in media, we like to make it. And this is just our take on... a lot of different stuff. Sometimes it's how it incorporates into our work. Sometimes it's just what we thought of it. It is a pretty free form podcast, but we do tend to have people that come back just to get kind of two indie filmmakers' view on what they're watching. So if that is your bag, then you have come to the right place. And with me as always is Edward Burgos, not Edward Booger, because that's what I would have called him in grade school, poor guy.
You were a mean
don't worry.
One.
I really wasn't. It was mainly like, it was lashing back at people because I was made fun of like constantly. Like, you know, I'm what, 5'11 now, but for most of grade school, I was like 3 feet. Like, I was the tiniest kid. And so people would just beat the crap out of me. So don't worry, Ed. Like, I was always put in my place when I was little. Nowadays, I'm just too tall for them to do that anymore. So, but yeah, Ed's with me. Ed is kind of heads up the directing side of things, and I head up the writing and the producing side of things, but we do love to switch it up when we can. But, yeah, thank you for joining us. Just to go over where you can catch us, we are on SoundCloud. That's where we kind of produce the broadcast. But you can also catch us on any other podcasting platform. My favorite way is Apple. That's where I get mine from. But Anchor will have us, and Podbean will have us. Just about everybody has us. If there's somewhere that you're not finding us, and you say, like, well, I like this particular venue, I'm happy to drop the RSS feed onto that one as well so you guys can get it. But that is the best way to catch this if you want to catch the show. If you want to see the wider stuff of what we do, then I encourage you to go to the website, which is www.lavictoria, so that's LavictoriaProductions.com. So lavictoriaproductions.com. That really is the mega site. That's where everything is. It's crowded right now, and I'm about to get a web designer to kind of look at it and re-slick it because it needs to look a little bit shinier than it does these days. But there's a ton there, and I really do encourage you that if you enjoy this stuff and you like the down and dirty approach, then there is tons for you to see. There's, you know, not only the podcast, not only Dirty 20, which is Ed's D&D show that he hosts every week, but there's also a multitude of our you know, previous short films. There's some stuff on the projects that we've been working on that needs to be updated, but there's still quite a bit there. And also, I always like there's a section in there for Ed's short films, because Ed obviously has been a filmmaker far longer than I have, and he had a lot of good stuff come out, which I've caught over the years, which I managed to get some of that up on the webpage with kind of good descriptions from Ed as to kind of how it was created and where it comes from. So please give it a gander. You know, we really do enjoy people visiting us and talking to us about it, because it is our life put to a page. So, you know, tell us what you think. I always like, you know, we still have the Halloween sizzle reel, which, just to correct that, that's the Halloween sizzle reel from last year, or maybe the year before, but I just like it so much it's been kept up for a long time. You can also catch us on social media. You know, Jason Shiro or Edward Burgos or Love Victoria Productions are on Facebook. We are on Instagram with Jazzy J. Shiro and Anano LVP. We're on Twitter with @MouthLoveVictoria and @AnanoskiProd. And we're also on LinkedIn with a Love Victoria Productions page. And then finally, you can catch us on TikTok. So occasionally I post under LVP Film Life. So that's everything. I'll shut up now. We always go to first impressions first. So 100th episode, no different. Dune, first impressions, Ed.
Oh, where to begin? Good Lord. Well, I think it's important to note that we went to watch it on an IMAX screen, which, I mean, if you can do that, 100%, that's what you should be doing, because it's a sensory journey, I would call it.
Sure. I mean, we can plug that for a minute for IMAX, even though they don't pay us, but, you know, we are cinephiles. Like, we absolutely love cinema, and, I mean, I go every week, and Ed works at a cinema, so we do, I feel like, know what we're talking about with this. And let me tell you, like, that little bit of extra bit for the IMAX just... I don't know with every film if it works. I haven't really ever seen a film that it doesn't work on, but that's usually because they're not showing on that screen.
Right, right. And you tend to be selective about which ones you go and watch on the IMAX.
Sure.
And you know, I think we both are big proponents of streaming services. We love you know, the fact that we can watch pretty much anything we want with the different ones that we've got. But occasionally there is, you know, a film or two a year that you're like, no, this really has to be watched on a big screen, and I think this is one of them.
I totally hear you. I mean, if you're looking at it from like a fan area, you know, like from a, I go to cinema, like, yes, this is one that you need to see there. If you're coming from like the filmy point of view where you're like, well, is this one that's better in IMAX? Yes. Like there are immense amount of my favorite things in the world, wide shots. So there are tons of wide shots in this one because it's that type of film. So yes, wide shots look amazing in IMAX. They don't always look amazing everywhere else. So the only thing that's going to suck for me, because this does happen, is then I take something like this, put it on my OLED, which usually looks cherry. Like everything looks so cherry on this thing. But because I saw it in the big world, I'll be like, oh, I want to see it on the IMAX again.
Yeah. That's true, but this is, I mean, look, first impression, this is a visual, sumptuous feast, and I think the sound, we'll probably talk about that, but I think that it also, it you know, it's, again, sensory, I don't want to say overload, but it's just a bombardment of your senses, and it's an experience.
No, we were talking about that on the drive home. Hans Zimmer does the sound on this one, and it's clear. Like, he's the kind of guy you want for stuff like this, because it adds. Like, I don't always, you know, we have a few friends now, at least one friend that I can think of, Mitch Bain, who does this, sound designer, and it's kind of what he does. And it's interesting to see the best ones are these guys that can come in and actually improve the quality of the film via their sound methods. And
just,
he has,
just,
you know,
just one little important thing, though. You know, it is important to distinguish you know, sound designer from the composer, in the sense that, you know, you're right, Hans Zimmer in this, like, he adds so much. But I was also very impressed by the sound design of the thumps, the way, like, because sound is such a big thing in the film, right? Like, it works. They did a really good job
of
it.
And it's a really good call out, because I actually just made an error there that Ed's pointing out. So, because I tend to just, producers, this is what we do. No, the sound designer may have been someone else. I know Hans Zimmer was who did the soundtrack and did everything on that. But, you know, sometimes there's someone who sits above that coordinates everything. And that's what a sound designer does, if you didn't know. A sound designer will make sure everything kind of fits the movie and sounds the way it's supposed to. So I don't know.
Very, very underappreciated.
Incredibly.
You know, you watch something like the Star Trek reboot from, I think it was 2009. And that film is just all about the sound design, you know, the phasers and the torpedoes and the ship. And I think they did a really, really good job on this one as well. Again, because it's like a desert, you know, a lot of it takes place on the desert. And there's, you know, the worms, again, we're going to talk about this, but that react to, like, you know, the rhythmic stuff. It was beautiful.
Yeah, it's definitely thought out. So I guess that's my take on this. Now, I love this film. Like, and Ed could tell you, because Jesus, poor guy, gets out of the theater at like 11 o'clock with me, or 10:30. We were going to do the podcast then, but we were both a little too tired for it. But, you know, I guess I could have done the podcast, because I just chattered on to him for like the hour it took me to get him back home. And I felt bad because he was so tired. But unfortunately, like, the book is one of my all-time favorite books. I've read it so many times. So I was just kind of downloading on Ed and being like, oh, my God, and this happened. And oh, my God, and this happened. What caution? Because I'm always the one that gives a little, that's the lawyer in me, is always going to caution you. Listen, this is like Denis Villeneuve's last one, Blade Runner. The last one that I saw. Now, he also did another one in between, which I only watched the first 10 minutes of. But when he did Blade Runner 2049, I would say that people will have the same complaints about this film that they had about that one.
Yeah.
Blade Runner 2049 is a gem to me. It's one of those, it was horribly underrated when it came out. Yeah. People were like, it's too slow, it's too long.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Like, it's because there were a lot of other bombastic things in the theater. But what I don't like is people always want this bombastic cinema. And I'm like, this is not bombastic, but something worth the spectacle. Mm. In other words, it's like a slow burn.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying it doesn't have its action pieces. It certainly has some amazing action pieces, but it's long. Mm. This is a saga. And so, and you're only getting like a glimpse of this saga within this film. So that's the only thing I would warn. If you're not ready to sit your ass on the seat for a good 2.5 hours and just veg out and enjoy, if you're looking for something that's like 90 minutes, get in, go, because maybe you've come back to the cinema and that's what you're looking for, this is not your film. Okay? Mm. And the problem you have right now, and it's funny because we did James Bond last week, you're actually going to struggle to find something like that because all the big films are now coming out. And so these are the longer ones. I would say if that's where you're leaning this week, like, and you want to go back to cinema, maybe Halloween Kills. Mm. You know what I mean? Go see that instead because it's a quicker...
Is that out yet?
No, that's November. Oh, okay. So, you know, end of the month, One Night in Soho comes out. That is, you know... That we, from what we've heard from other people, and we will do a podcast on that because we love Edgar Wright. But from what I've heard, that's a very stylistic piece. So that may be your alternative in a couple weeks. If you don't want to see the big budget Bond or the big budget Dune, then catch One Night in Soho as you return to cinema. But for everyone else, and for everybody who has that like deep love of cinema. And so when I ask that for you, I'm talking about, do you look on your shelf and do you have, you know, if you're from the 80s, you'll have your Back to the Futures and your Indiana Jones. If you're from the 90s, you know, you may have the Matrix trilogy, stuff like that. You know, 2000s was the plethora when you had Harry Potter, Lord of the Rings. It's all up there. That's this kind of stuff. You know, that's what we're talking about. And nowadays, you have the MCU, but I'm hesitant because I do find the MCU tends to fall more into that bombastic category, which I don't dislike. You guys know I'm the biggest MCU fan in the world. However... like, this is different. This is not an MCU film.
It's nice that there's variety, though, right? Like,
exactly.
You know, if everything was MCU, as much as we love it, it would get dull. And, you know, there's been that danger in the past few years. So it's nice to see.
2 minute rant. I think the danger you have with things like the MCU, offering a counterpoint to the fact that I absolutely love them, it's like Apple, okay? I used to be kind of vehemently against Apple because I'm just that type of person. Now I have everything Apple. But, you know, I went through a phase where I got tired of the fact that everything was Apple. Like, anything good, anything you had to have had to be branded with an Apple on it. And I don't like Ed said, like, not having the choice. Mm. I like to be able to say, okay. So then I remember I switched over to a Samsung, I think, on that year. And now I'm back on Apple for everything again. But Ed's exactly right. Like, there's nothing wrong. There needs to be variety in cinema. And this is offering you that kind of opportunity. So it's really, you know, it's been put into the cinema goers' hands. That's why, again, both of us would say, go see this. Mm. You know what I mean? Because if you don't go see this, then it does prove the MCU's right and they make less of these types of films. So I think it's worth your while. Again, it's just the warning that if you're going for the first time and you're not looking to be there long, well, skip this one. Maybe catch another one, you know, because it just isn't going to work. But those are my first impressions. Anything else to add to that, Ed?
There's one thing that I don't know if we should talk about it now or later, but it was kind of the biggest surprise for me.
Yes. Definitely hit upon that, Ed.
Like, I didn't know that it was the first part of supposedly what's going to be like a two-part, saga. I don't know. Beginning. That's the thing, though. You hit the nail on the head because this shit is like franchise level stuff. I mean, in potentially, this has what, you know, your Harry Potter's had and other things like that.
Well, the only thing that always gets me about Dune is everyone looks at, like, the... because there's, like, 9 of them. Mm. And I think, like, there's only a few people I know that have read all of them. Eggy, you're on there. My buddy Greg Fairbanks, an old grade school friend. I remember him posting on Facebook that he'd actually read all those books. And I was like, wow, that's amazing. Because I made it up to number 7 and then stopped halfway through. Because they're really samey after the 6th one. Mm-hmm. They really are just the same book over and over and over again. So, but... I guess my counter, you know, always counterpoints. My point to that is the first book alone offers you a franchise. Mm-hmm. You could literally dial that 350 or 400 pages into like 7 films if you really wanted to. Right. There's so much going on. So it's very important that Ed brought that up because it caught both of us by surprise. And I think it was, after giving a night to think about it as a producer, I'm almost positive it was a deliberate misstep by Legendary, by Universal. Mm. It's Universal, I think, that backed this one. Mm. They don't want you to know that this is part one.
Oh, interesting.
And that means there's going to be an abrupt stop to this before the end.
Yeah.
And it's whether you can live with that or not. It's not. It doesn't feel. It has a first act, a second act, and a third act. Okay. Mm. So if it didn't do that, if it didn't conclude, then I would definitely be railing against this because I would tell you, I'm the story man. You can't write half a story. I used to get so pissed off when they did that. Like Back to the Future 2 forever will be my favorite and my least favorite film because of that, because it just left me with such a cliffhanger at the end. And I was like, you can't do that. This one, it's not like that per se. Like, you're going to want to know what happens at the end. However, it's a logical point to stop the film.
It's a really nice surprise as well. Like, I was in the cinema and I really wanted the film to keep going. And it felt, not having read the books, it felt like there was a lot more to it that was to come. And then it kind of stops and it's the ending.
The ending is similar to Fellowship, okay? Mm. It was like in Fellowship. Mm. If you hadn't read the Lord of the Ring books, right, all of a sudden you're like, wait, what the fuck? Yeah, why are they all doing what they're doing?
And it's but
just like that. Yeah. Like, you know, you had that feeling. You know there's more to be had, but you're not quite sure what it's going to be.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's why, you know, like I said, maybe it's because I was satisfied with the ending of Fellowship of the Ring that I'm satisfied with this one too, being like, yeah, well, it was a good stopping point, but there's, you know, if you go to see Dune Part 1, you're going to want to go see Dune Part 2. So if that puts a bee in your bonnet, and I really think it's good to bring up in the last, because, you know, we're up to 16 minutes now, so it's not like we've been going on and on about this, but it's important. Like, if you're going to go see this, understand that you're going to go back. It's like It Part 1. You were always going to see It Part 2, which was a shame because It Part 2 was never as good as It Part 1.
Yeah, you know, but what? I never caught it.
Really?
Yeah, I should.
So proving me completely wrong as usual, Burgos. No, I love it.
It's funny, though, but maybe because It Part 1 was so satisfying, I didn't feel the need to like rush out and watch, and you know that I'm not like
it almost shattered the satisfying element of it, like, because obviously they're all adults now. Like, I think Ed, I agree that when we saw the first one, and again, this shows kind of the kinship between, you know, I call it the triangle, like Ed, myself, and Becky. That's my life. Like, those are the best people in my life. My daughter forms the kind of the square with that, but obviously she's younger. And Ed, Becky, and I are like best friends, you know what I mean? And when we saw that film, it just reminded us all of being kids, and we were like kids with each other again, you know what I mean? Becky has that Losers Club shirt that she always wears, and I love
the bag that she got.
All that, because like that's what she's doing for Halloween, man. She's going to dress up my wife, who is like, oh, she's perpetually cool, right? She's going to be right. She bought, when we were in America, we went to Hot Topic, which, if those of you who don't know, that is like the alternative Claire's.
Accessorized,
like the alternative accessorized in boys shop there too. That's where I got all my jewelry from. And so Becky had never been into one, so I took her in and it was like, oh my god. And I was like, I know, right? Like, memorabilia, paraphernalia, like everything you can think of in this place. And then there was an SS Georgie bag, and it's a bag, like a hand clutch, that is designed to look like the paper boat. Like, sorry, the fashion guy in me is just like, oh my god, that's so cool, you know what I mean? So, do you know what I mean? Like, it was, and she's bought herself now the yellow, you know, the raincoat or whatever it is. She told me the name of what it is, and I can't remember now. But whatever it is, she's bought that so she can go out with her little clutch handbag and she's going to be Georgie.
That's wicked.
And it's just, it's wicked. Yeah. So that's a really good point, Ed. Like, if for some reason, again, it goes back to that 90 minute, I want to be in and out. Like, if this is not a saga you want to join, then maybe not catch this one.
Yeah.
Everybody else, yeah. I mean, balancing that against, is this a spectacle of cinema? I would say it's a spectacle of cinema. Go see it. You know what I mean?
Like, anyone who likes sci-fi, I think, should 100% see this.
Fans of like one of my all-time favorite, and Ed has to hear about this film incessantly, unfortunately, but one of my favorite older films is Metropolis.
Yeah.
Just because, like, the set design on that wasn't recreated until stuff like this. That's what's amazing to me. Now, they've done it in a different way in Dune. Obviously, we've done it via CGI rather than via large structures. But it, you know, the CGI is tight. Like, it's really tight.
And they did
a lot
of location stuff. I mean, in that sense, it visually, it reminds me of something like Lawrence of Arabia, you know, where you have those just sweeping vistas that lend themselves to a very, like, epic scale, you know. And
well, it brings me up to the other reason that everybody has to go see this, truthfully, like, whether you agree with this or not, we really want you to see the film, because this, for me at least, was the first time I had a friend, like, on the screen credits for real. And he's been on the show, so you guys would know him. Richard Roundtree is the Greensman on this one.
Yeah.
So, and I mean, we cheered. God, I just, that those kind of things really...
We were worried we were going to miss it, because, like, it was going so fast.
Well, and it's just the kind of thing, because people always think that I'm obsessed with these things because I'm obsessed with celebrity. That's not it, guys. And those who work in our studio know that, like, I do love meeting celebrities, but that's because I consider them, like, fellow creators. And Richard's, like, one of them. Like, and he's not a celebrity, obviously. Like, when he's listened to his podcast with us, he'll tell you just how much, like, he thinks people overplay working in the cinema industry. Exactly, right? But, like, we had, he sent us something, I think, or he tweeted about it, and I retweeted him back on it. And, yeah, we were in there, like, the three people in the theater were like, what the hell are those two guys going on about? But yeah, it's really cool. So everybody, you've got to go see it just so we can honor one of our friends who's in film. You know what I mean? Like, that's so cool. So, and if you didn't know, the Greensman is the person who does all the plants. I found that out from Richard. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, so he must have done those, the sacred trees and stuff like that, right?
Right, right.
Which is, like, central to the story. I mean, that's cool, right?
So the stuff you don't have, and if you want it, then you've got to, like, bug me to see if I can't get him back on the show, at least to give you some of the anecdotes. But he had some really cool stories from, like, being out there, because he didn't tell us that's what he was doing, but we knew it. Mm-hmm. Like, it was one of those things that while it was shooting, it was all, like, hush, hush. And it's like, well, I was out in Jordan doing this thing. And you're like, really? Jordan, of all places? Isn't there a big desert out there? And he's like, yeah, kind of. And you're like, huh. Isn't there this big desert movie coming out soon? Huh. So, you know what I mean? So we connected the dots for it. But, yeah, I'd love to get him on to talk about some of the he had some crazy cool shit happen out there that he talked to us about, and I would love for him to share if I can get him on. But that's never a promise. It's said people promise to come on my podcast all the time and then disappear. You guys know who you are. All right, let's move on, Ed, to talk about, briefly, because I do want to spend a lot of time on Dune, but briefly, what were we watching this week, dude?
I have been watching very disposable stuff. So there's a new adult comedy, animated comedy on Netflix called Inside Job.
That's right, number 6 in the UK.
Yeah, it makes fun of, like, you know, spies and evil villains with their, like, lairs and stuff like that. It's pretty cool, it's pretty funny. I'm not, like, utterly in love with it or anything, but it's cool. The other thing that I watched was Solar Opposites, which I think I was telling you about, Jay, yesterday. It's Justin Roiland, one of the creators of Rick and Morty, and it's aliens trying to live, like, suburban lives in the US, you know?
Oh, God, you did, but I forgot, like, the plot of that, and so I thought, when I went on the number 6 in UK, this thing you were talking about, I thought that was it. Because you know me, I'm an idiot, right? Like, I always combine what you're telling me, and I was like, oh, okay. I didn't, from the trailer of it, I was like, this looks really disposable, so I'm not going to watch it.
Yeah. Solar Opposites, I mean, I'm on the second episode. I haven't kind of quite made my mind up. It feels a little bit like Alf, but with, like, you know, more rudeness with, like, Rick and Morty.
Yeah, no. This is what I was about to ask. So, is it not a cartoon then? So it's live action.
No, it's a cartoon. It's a cartoon, okay. And it's very much in the Rick and Morty style, you know. But yeah, it's just interesting, and it's on Disney Plus.
Okay. Yeah. I have to check that out, man.
Yeah. And the last thing that I kind of have been watching, I haven't finished it yet, is on Netflix. There's a Witcher animated.
You said it was actually pretty decent.
Nightmare of the Wolf, it's called. Like, the animation's really, really cool. For some reason it fits better than the actual Witcher show did with me.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, we talked about this briefly about The Witcher. And listen, it's not that I don't like Henry Cavill, although I'm not as in love with him as some other people are. Like, I just don't.
Because he's a nerd like me. He paints little miniature soldiers.
Oh, well, see, everybody's got the connection, right? I guess I don't have that connection. That's why I'm like, I didn't mind him as Superman. I don't mind him as The Witcher. I just don't also think he's, like, sometimes I there's the guys like that, and I just think nowadays you have more dynamic actors. It's we'll talk about this when we talk about Lady Jessica in Dune and kind of who you pick for these things. So, but The Witcher itself, like, the video game, I loved. Like, I played the original, played the sequel, didn't beat either of those, but then played the third one pretty extensively. And the show reminds me a bit of the tutorial level. Like, there's an initial land you come to in The Witcher 3, you have to play through it to get through everything else. And every strategy guide you read will say play through it as quickly as you can because it's so boring. And that's how I kind of felt. Like, I never watched past, like, episode 2 of The Witcher because it just didn't get going fast enough for me. I was like, I don't get why this is kind of going backwards in time for all of this. And but then I heard about this animation, and I was looking back at an article I'd read. I think it was Variety that said this is an animation that helps bring, you know, something for the whole family. Mm. Like, you could watch that with your, you know, 12-year-olds at least, and they could watch The Witcher, whereas the show is definitely not designed for that. You know, The Witcher is generally an adult. It's
a little gory, though, I would say, because there's no, like, but some, like, fucking children get ripped apart and stuff.
Oh, maybe not then. Sorry. Like, maybe don't. The worst thing happens when you podcast about something and say, oh, you can watch it with your kids. And then somebody does that in college and be like, you are an asshole. And I'm like, dude, my bad. Trust me, I've done it before. So Harry Potter 4, that's the famous, like, so my daughter is obsessed with Harry Potter, but she's been obsessed with Harry Potter since she was, God, when did that start, Ed? Like 4 or 5? Like years ago now. And now, like, my whole house is Harry Potter, which is fine because we love Harry Potter here. But so she started watching the films back in the day, like a couple years ago with me, and it was fine. But she got up to like the 4th one and I wasn't there, and she was watching with her mother. And I get this phone call while I'm at work, and her mom is pissed. And her mom was like, you didn't remind me about the 4th one. I'm like, what didn't I remind you of? And, you know, Cedric Diggory, who's played by Robert Pattinson, it's one of his first roles, drops dead. Yeah. Like, literally, it's dread. Pretty, and she was like,
it's pretty traumatic.
It's grim. It's really grim. And the problem is she was like 4 or 5, so she just bawled. Like, she just didn't understand.
Did she not have trouble with Buckbeak and the execution?
No. Like, all of that, like, she made it through the 3rd one fine. It was just because that's the first time in Harry Potter that things get dark. Mm. Like, someone actually dies and someone is actually, you know, not saved in the end. Cedric's dead, you know, and he's way past dead. And the worst part is, like, no one believes it. You know what I mean? So, like, and that happens in the 5th one. So, do you know what I mean? Like, she actually went on to watch the rest of the films later, but then we held off for another year or two watching those last two because, you know, Deathly Hallows were very adult, I thought. Like, teenagery, at least. And so, nowadays, she loves them all. She's just finished the 4th book and moving on to the 5th one. And, I mean, she's a teenager herself now. She's 7 years old going on 20. So, do you know what I mean? But, yeah, like, that can play a factor in those kind of things. So.
Yep. What have you been watching, then?
All right. So, I told you I broke into my I finished all the Halloweens. Mm-hmm. So I've watched every Halloween except for the most recent one, which I was supposed to catch like 2 weeks ago and just missed. Mm-hmm. But I will catch it at some point. There are ones I love and there are ones I hate. Mm-hmm. And I can always live with that when it's horror, because that's how horror works.
Yeah,
like,
I'm the same with science fiction. Yeah.
When you do legacies like that, some of them will be good, some will be bad, and everyone has a different opinion of which ones are good and which ones are bad. For me, the Paul Rudd one was a surprise on how bad it was.
Okay.
Halloween 2, the clincher to be a surprisingly good sequel, mm-hmm. I thought. You know, I might get lynched for that. I had to buy a German copy of that because you couldn't find that in UK distribution. Mm. The reboot for 2018, I quite liked. Mm. So that's the most recent reboot, the Blumhouse one that they made a sequel to with Halloween mm-hmm. Kills. Mm-hmm. I quite like that one. It was at times cliche, but it's Blumhouse. So that's the beauty you have of when his name comes across it. Like, I know his other films like Happy Death Day, the stuff he finances. And so I always know there's got to be a bit of Kish in it because that's how he gets everybody to go, as opposed to just the horror buffs. He mm-hmm. has like funny comedy and kind of cliche. The ones that kind of like sat on the fence for me and still do, surprise, surprise, are the Rob Zombie ones.
Interesting.
Rob Zombie, yes, they are definitely his films. Mm. I'm just not always into look how cool White Trash is. Mm. Like, I get it. You know, Hillbilly Deluxe, it's part of his, like, genre, his brand. It's just, I grew up in the sticks. And so it's like, people like that scare the fucking shit out of me, because those are the type of dudes that wanted to like tie me up and put me in their trunk sometimes because they didn't like people with my skin color or something like that. So I have trepidation when he exposes it and then tries to glorify it almost to me. Like, he almost makes a point of making it cool to be poor white trash. And I'm like, I guess, like, you know, like, everybody has their own opinions. Some people love Rob Zombie, but I just don't get the aesthetic. Like, I'm like, it's not cool. A lot of the kills in those Halloweens are really gory, and it's always so depressing. That's the other thing that I agree with. The sticks are like that people in the Rust Belt at the moment, and you hear stories about this all the time because of the drugs and everything else, live some very depressing lives in general now. You know what I mean? Like, some of these places are hopeless, but I don't like making movies about that kind of hopelessness because I don't think it takes us anywhere. So that's just, again, it's aesthetic, not point. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's not a good point for me to make. It's more just, I'm not really keen on that kind of stuff because it gets too close to home on people that I don't like. That being said, the other thing that's weird about them is that, you know, he goes in his own directions for explaining different things, and there are always those, like, long and gory explanations, where I think Halloween always benefits, as a whole, from the lack of explanation to things. John Carpenter creates this ultimate serial killer with just a face mask. What really gets me about that series, Ed, is you can compare it to Friday the 13th, you can compare it to Nightmare on Elm Street, but both of those series have much more bells and whistles to what they do. John Carpenter made this series on just the basic premise of a guy with no motive going around slashing at teenage girls. You know, the original slasher. That's still a validly scary kind of point. You know what I mean? Like, it's really sad that in 2021, there really is the same scenario for the slasher to exist that there was in 1978 when the first Halloween came out. I mean, that's the coolest and the worst thing about the series is it works because the situation, and we were talking about this, me and you, and I was talking this a lot with one of my friends that came over on Sunday, about, like, the situation for women hasn't changed. You know what I mean? Like, just hasn't. You know what I mean? Like, it's still just as scary to be out in things than it was there, so... Anyways, that's the Halloween films. I will look forward to Halloween Kills. I heard it's not as good as Halloween, you know, the reboot, but whatever. Like, it'll be a good hour and a half in the cinema and in a good time. I'm sure I'll be next to some dipshit with his phone on, and I'll be like, ah, whatever.
Nice.
So I watched that, and then the other thing that I watched that you were interested in hearing about was the Barking Dogs Never Bite, Bong Joon-ho's first film.
That's right, first feature.
Amazing. Like, just watch it. You know what I mean? I mean, if this is indie from Korea, it's like, Jesus, like, I'm so... And it's not indie. Like, there's a lot of money. That's the other thing I love about Korea is, I mean, their big conglomerates always put up money. If it's not Lotte, it's you know, it's Shuangyang. You know, there's so many that put in money to make sure these get made. And they get grants from the government as well. But Bong Joon-ho's first one, like, it sets the scene very well for the type of director he is. You know, everything is nuanced. Everything has a point. And that's what I love about his films. Almost, like, it's funny coming off of a Paul Thomas Anderson week and then on to that, because they do what Paul Thomas Anderson does with his shots, but they do it better because there's no wasted story. And that's what I think happens with, like, that artsy stuff, you know, artsy stuff. That's so terrible. Come over and smack me, Paul Thomas Anderson, because I'm sorry I'm calling your stuff artsy stuff. But I think you lose the story sometimes because we're more worried about the damn shot. Like, again, go back to what we were talking about in last week's podcast, the girl with the green dress. Like, I would have made her a major character. Why? Because she was stunning on the screen. Like, I don't care what you do for her. Do something. Because all of a sudden, I wanted to know who's that. You know, not just because I like girls in green dresses. You know, with Barking Dogs Don't Bite, like, he creates some really detestable characters that you still follow. And that's what I loved. Like, he never, like, pegs anything as the same thing it is in the beginning. Every character in his story goes through some form of catharsis. And so that's kind of how, you know, this works. You know, it pegs itself together. I love how they also blend, like, things that, like, Almodovar does with having multiple storylines going at the same time that are all going to interweave. Now, obviously, Almodovar does it to long extent to the point that sometimes you're lost and like, okay, so what are we doing now? Todo sobre mi madre, you know what I mean? Like, why is there a pregnant nun? Wait, what? But I don't think he goes that far. Like, Bong Joon-ho is pretty good at railing it back in that everybody has a reason that they're connected to each other. It's not just because we live in this great world, don't we, and everybody has these streams of life. So go and watch it. It's his first one, so the you know, the things I will say, it's lower budget than some of his other stuff. Obviously, it's not Snowpiercer, it's not, you know, even Parasite, I don't think was that high budget, but it doesn't have quite the shine that Parasite has to it. But equally, it has some very interesting, valid looks at things. I was really surprised that this is followed by Memoirs to a Murder, because it seems almost like Memoirs to a Murder, I'm actually having trouble getting through because I forgot how slow it is at times. It's really great, but it's this epically long, you know, discussion.
It's very easy to nod off during it.
Right, you know, Memoirs of Murder, if you don't know, is one of my, it still remains one of my favorite films, but it's about trying to catch a killer, and like, the whole point of the film is that they have a really hard time catching the killer.
Oh, you know what I mean? There's a new, like, true crime series on Netflix as well about...
A Korean one, yeah. The Raincoat Killer. Yeah, yeah, right. And it's not the same guy, is it? It's not the one that this is written
about. I think it might be the same kind of basic story, yeah.
I mean, as a starting point, it's kind of thing. What I do never bogs darking bark darking barking dogs never bite or Memories of Murder is your first one. I would say Memories of Murder. Like that just shows you his craftsmanship because even though it's a slower film, it's a bit longer. Like once you get through all the things he's trying to do, then and he accomplishes those things, it's quite impressive. You know what I mean? Yeah, you're like,
and it's just a little bit easier to get an audience member on board with a mystery. It's just because we're so used to that as a kind of genre, you know, of film and stuff like that.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. Barking Dogs Never Bite is like a slice of life type of film. Like, it you know, and Koreans are really good at that kind of stuff. But it is, there's no, like, I guess it's a dude with a problem film. You know what I mean? Which is, those can be anywhere. So, yeah, so I watched that this week. I quite enjoyed it. I mean, I've mentioned it on the podcast before and encourage you all, if you are fans of Korean cinema and especially Bong Joon-ho, the Curzone collection for him is just cherry. Like, it's so well put together. It has all of his films. They look dynamic. They have really good special features. Like, just amazed. You know what I mean? Like, well done. Yeah, it's the time and the care, because they know a guy like me really appreciates someone who does it, because I'm only going to buy so many of those things. That's why I bought the Star Wars one. Even though you hear me rail against that I hate the Skywalker saga, they made a really good box set, so I put the money out for it, because it's just, it is immaculate. It looks really nice. It has some good pages in there on the background, and yeah. So that was this week, other than Dune. But let's get to bum 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 Dune! So I almost feel like we should kind of go back to, we used to use an old approach where I went through different categories and we talked about those. And I went away from that because oftentimes we would miss out on talking about cooler things because we were so worried about these categories. But here, because there are so many different aspects that Ed and I want to talk about related to those categories, I think it is easier to just jump in and start with, like, first thing I guess we could talk about is, you know, start with A for acting. Cool. All right. So sorry, we're just picking up there for a second, whether that stays in or not. We lost contact. We lost contact. Houston, I was saying
we have a problem.
Exactly. I was saying, I did you hear the whole point about the categories, Ed? I was talking about like using the category.
I caught the very beginning of it, but not the whole thing.
Remember how we used to use categories, Ed? I think that might be the best way to approach this one, just so we talk about all the really cool aspects of this. So, okay. I mean, let's start with the visual, like the shots. Like, what did you love about that? What did you not love about that?
I'll be honest, visually is where if we were giving scores, I'd give like 10 out of 10.
That's why I thought we should start there. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we're looking at, Denis Villeneuve, who is the director of Dune, a French Canadian fella who I first came across with a film called Prisoners. With Hugh Jackman and Jake Gyllenhaal.
Okay.
It's a really, really good film. And since then, he hasn't made a bad film, in my opinion. He did Prisoners. He did Enemy, which is a really weird science fiction film. He did Sicario, which was a really, really good...
Yeah, I've not seen that, but man, people go on and on about Sicario.
Really good, really good. Again, visually, just brilliant. He did Arrival, and then he did Blade Runner 2049. I mean, for me, since Prisoner, he's been, like, you know, batting 100, really.
Ah, but you skipped the one he's known that people didn't like. The wasn't he the one that did the, it begins with a V. The Vitruvian, or, oh, God, what was it? It was, like, two people running from...
Ah, no. That was Besson, Luc Besson.
Is it?
Valerian.
Yes, yeah. I thought he did the Valerian tale.
No. That's not Denis.
Oh, no. Well, that explains why you were saying that. Because I kept thinking, like, but he did that one that was bad. But no, it was Besson. Sorry, Luke, because we love you too. French director. Very cool guy. Okay, well, no, then, yeah, this is very much... I mean, 2049, then, would be the only one that had mixed reviews. Because when Blade Runner came out, people just thought it was a bit too long. Which it is. It's the problem you had with Blade Runner. It was what I said in the first impressions. The problem with Blade Runner, it goes more to what we'll talk about in story. It was the exact same problem you had on this one, that it is a bit long. So if you're not prepared to hunker down in your seat.
And I think that is, you know, that's an element often of his films. This is a guy who likes slow burns, you know.
Yeah, I mean, from what I can tell from his other stuff, like, listen, no director that I can see on the big screen, even Christopher Nolan, who really should be the better one for this, no one gets perspective, like size perspective, better than him. He understands that if you want to make something massive on the screen, it really has to be massive. Like, you can't just make these dinky things. It always reminds me of, like, that great Spinal Tap moment where the Stonehenge comes down, and it was, like, because they didn't tell them it was feet, not inches, it comes down, like, and it's this rock. I don't know if you've seen Spinal Tap, Ed. It's a parody about a rock and roll band, and they want Stonehenge to come down while they're playing. It's their great moment, but they gave the directors of the show the sketch for it, and the directors of the show lower this, like, 10-inch tall when it's supposed to be like, or like 30-inch tall when it's supposed to be like 30 feet tall. And it's just a big gag. And the worst is they have a little person, which I think that's the correct term now for them, like dancing around that, because obviously this was the 80s where this is what they did. Such is a fun let's film. Let's just stick little people in things to make it more interesting.
I love Christopher Guest. We should do a whole podcast on his films.
But like, so you have that little guy, and that's what I mean when I see sci-fi that doesn't do perspective properly. Like, and a lot of sci-fi gets it kind of right, but not completely right. Like, even Battlestar Galactica had issues with that, where things don't look big enough. This, you're never going to complain about that. Things look huge, you know what I mean? Like, really, really big. And when you're dealing with, like, a space opera, like, that's what you need. Like, because you have to...
Yeah, and I think this also comes back to the whole, like, if you can watch it on IMAX, because literally, I found myself, like, turning my head to focus on different parts of the screen, and it just adds a lot to everything that you're talking
about. That's right. So a great example, because we're getting into spoilers now, so we're assuming you have watched the film now and you know what happens. If you haven't, turned this off now, because we're going to start explaining some shots. But like, one of the greatest sequences is of course the massacre, when everything goes wrong. It happens quick in the book, so when we get to the story section, I will point out that a lot of the things are just ripped straight from the pages, but it happens quickly. And, you know, I say it happens quickly in the book, and maybe that's not even true, because maybe I would say there's also like 10 pages of build up with different characters into that. He skips all that, gets to the Greta, but then when you see, you know, the Harkonnens coming in and the Atreides desperate to get off the planet or fix something, you are doing, as Ed said, you're looking to the right to see the Harkonnens landing their ships, and then you're looking to the left to see the Atreides running and trying to get out, and you're literally and then watching
trapped behind
with exactly. With the there's like, another set of Harkonnens. I mean, you're literally watching two ends of the screen to see what happens next, yeah. And it's like a tennis match. You're really going back and forth, and I'll tell you, it's been even MCU films. I can't remember the last one I did that. You know what I mean? So,
and again, to your point of scale, you know, a very big, emblematic, iconic image of Dune is the worms, and it, you know, it's not disappointing when it comes up close.
I would say that was the first thing he had to get right, because there's such a critical part of the story. Mm. And every, like, fanboy will have a huge word to say about Shai Hulud.
And it is very, very interesting. And I remember you mentioned about it when we came out of the theatre. Because whereas in the book and in the previous David Lynch version, there's a very epic moment of discovering that these worms can be ridden. Here, it's kind of a little bit of an afterthought. But I think that was interesting because everyone's expecting it. Everyone knows it's coming, you know. Like, I think you're right. You had to get the scale of them right first.
Yeah,
Understand, like, what a feat that is.
That's exactly it. It's what, you know, I really didn't like the criticisms on Blade Runner, because they were like, it's slow, it's boring, it doesn't take it anywhere. And I was like, it is slow. I don't know why you would think that story was boring. It was the same story from the original Blade Runner. And it's not the same in the fact that it's the same characters, but it's the same kind of replicant, who's real, who's not real. I mean, Jared Leto's character scares the living fuck out of me in that film. You know, it was such a big world. And I was like, no, this is what you want, isn't it? Like, you want to be able to recreate it. And so literally, you feel like you're living in that world. And I just feel like he does that better than a lot of other directors who try to do that. You know, the reason I bring up Christopher Nolan. No, go ahead, Ed.
I was just going to say, I will admit, I did not watch 2049 on the big screen, and it's one of my biggest regrets.
Yeah, it's the only reason, because I know what you mean, because I can go back to it now on my OLED and I'll put up with the fact that it doesn't look as good and it's not as cool, because I sat there and I remember the theater was empty when I was there, like three of us in that place, and I was so happy about that, because usually I get stuck to that popcorn eating motherfucker. But you know what I mean? Like, I did this time. I don't know if you noticed that in Dune, but we did have a guy that was like crinkling the bag and eating popcorn.
There was a lot of crinkling.
I just kept shooting the evil glances.
It's the one thing about going to the theater that is just the pain in the ass.
Oh, you know, and that's me. That's just me being pompous. Like, fuck it. Like, that's the whole reason you go to the theater, so you can crunch popcorn if you want to. It's just, I'm not a popcorn cruncher and I have sensitive ears, so what the fuck ever. But yeah, I mean, going back to the shots and things like that, you know, the other reason this works, again, is the choice of shots. You know, he is not afraid of his wide shots. And again, that's why, because, you know, I think the biggest problem you have with some directors, especially indie directors, and trust me, this is me included, is you do a wide shot and then you don't put any action in the shot. It's like an establishing shot. So here's a nice big field. Like, great. Like, that's really great, but why am I looking at the field? What he does that's different, he says, here's a big field and here's some people moving on it. And you're like, that's why I love Memories of Murder, Ed, because there's not one field shot in there that there's not something going on, something to get your eye. Even when he's like searching for the dead girl in the thing, like, there's still stuff happening in the background that you can watch. Like, don't ever put a wide shot in there that doesn't have something for you to see. Like, and so that's what I mean when I see that this guy, he'd have his wide shot, so he has the big megalith something or other coming straight to the screen, but then he's got action going on the screen as well. So you're not just, so what makes me think of that is the shots, like some of my favorite shots, because I think they encapsulated just the stakes that you're talking about in the film, which are very hard to get across because it's a space opera, it's a saga, is like when they arrive on when the messenger came in Caladan and they bring the Emperor's guard. And I just thought that was perfect because, like, this massive ship just lands and then there's this big pageantry on both sides. It's very similar, you know, originally started with Seven Samurai. Kurosawa does it at the end of that. There's this huge pageantry moment at the end where they're awarding the Seven Samurai and everybody's talking about how great they are. That was ripped off and that's done well. If you like those closing scenes, the Skywalker saga, the ones that are in every single one, because that's how he has to end his films, when these big, you know, banners are draped, you're always in a big hall and everybody's cheering, that's Dune. They've done that with not just one shot, but they've done that with like two dozen shots and said, you will understand how big this world is by these scenes. You know what I mean? Yeah, so that's how I felt on the visual. Anything else that you'd like to mention about the visual that maybe like an effect or something you thought was particularly cool?
I quite liked, again, I'm going to, you know, throw some love at the sound designer, a fellow named Theo Green.
Okay. Who's also thank you for finding his name on
Blade Runner as well. But there's like this, it's not a magical power, but there's this skill, this way of commanding people that the Bene Gesserit order has, right? Which Paul's mother has kind of tried to teach him.
Right, the voice.
Yeah, the voice. And just the way it's done is very satisfying. Again, it's something that if you get it wrong, it could just sound so terrible.
It's okay, you know? So compare it with how David Lynch did it, right? So the voice is like I love the science fiction behind all this, because that's where Dune again excelled. Like, the science fiction behind it is there's the Bene Gesserit have created frequencies which are commanding to the brain. And so if you can talk at that particular pitch, because everything, all pitch is just frequency. So that frequency is just scientific, and the amount of undulations you have on the wave. So if you can do a sound wave at the right frequency, right, so the right peaks and troughs on it, you can control someone's actions. And they've perfected that, and they've trained people how to do that. Now, David Lynch does this. Again, you have the whole of the Dune saga. So, and this isn't ruining the second one for you too much, but in the David Lynch version, Stilgar is the first time you really see the voice, because what happens is Lady Jessica and Stilgar, you know, kind of buddy up, and she teaches him the voice because they're going to start attacking the Harkonnens. This is everything that's going to happen in part two for you. And so
Stilgar played by Javier Bardem in this one?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, gotcha.
So, but his character, and he's played by a really cool guy in the Lynch one, someone that's like a famous actor from that time. I mean, he's a really cool actor in that one as well. But the way they show that is by them breaking stone. And so they'll go like, "Hwah!" And then there's like, you know, there's no visual to it. It's just the stone cracks and shatters. Mm. And I agree, like with you, this was done better because there is a sound with it. Like there's a definite sound, but there's also like a little bit of VFX done with it. Like a very tiny bit that was like so subtle, you wouldn't notice at first, but it worked. Like it just,
100%.
Almost like airwaves, you know what I mean? And it just, I completely agree that sometimes the special effects work so well in this one because they're subtle. They're not, they make room for other things. In this case, it's making room for the sound design to really control the flow of this because it's a sound issue. It's not something that you're going to show somebody by showing them visually. You have to kind of let them hear it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Which is still showing them.
Yeah. And also the production design of the, I think they call them thopters in the film, but the vehicles that have like dragonfly wings and stuff like that, I thought that was really, really cool. And they had such heft to them. Everything felt like it had weight. And
I mean, this is the thing, because you'll have Paige. This is why I want to make one of these films one day, because what they got to do was like open the book and just pour through the descriptions and try to figure it out for them. And I did that again last night to see, because I couldn't remember. Everything looks very insect-like. And I was like, I don't remember them doing that. To be fair, like, it's an interpretation of what they're saying, and that's what I really liked, because that's the whole point, and we'll talk about this when we get to the story, but adaptation. You have to make judgment calls on, okay, well, what are we going to do? And sometimes that's going to be deviating from the book. Here, they're not deviating, they're just embellishing. They're saying, like, okay, what would look really cool? And someone sat around, the production designer, like you said, you know, either had someone on his team or came up with it themselves to say, what if we made them look like dragonflies? That's pretty cool. That looks futuristic. And I'm, you know, whoever designed that, I'm completely with you. One look at that and I would have been like, yes, we're using those. Like, that is awesome. But the coolest part about all of this, guys, is production designers probably would have had like 11 to 12 to 100 to 150 passes at this. This is why you have to wait for the behind the scenes, because they'll tell you, like, they have so many different iterations. Whatever made the director point his finger at that one and say, that's the one I want, like, cheers to you, Denise. Like, that's just really, really cool.
Yeah, the production designer was Patrice Vermette, who's like he's collaborated a lot of times with him. So I mean, he does excellent work.
Sounds, are they're Quebecois, right? This is I didn't know that. I thought he was French. Like, so even cooler, man, because I love the Quebecois. I used to live there. I mean, that's for me on visual. Just so many, the little things were taken care of and the big things were taken care of. So if anything, that's the highest rating you can give this film is the visuals. Like, it's
that
just
does not disappoint. Yeah.
No, like go for the spectacle. Like, you know, if you really hate it midway through it, just tune it out and watch it. You know what I mean? Don't even listen to what's going on. Just watch everything that's going on.
Yeah.
So
the cinematography, yeah. Greg Fraser was cinematographer on this one. Roger Deakins has often collaborated with Denis Villeneuve.
I was just about to say that. Yeah. Like, was Deakins the original choice on this one? I could have sworn we thought Deakins was doing this. Like,
yeah,
I could have sworn we had a previous podcast where we're like, isn't Deakins doing all of this?
Yeah, I think he was originally, but, you know, scheduling and stuff like that.
Okay, so we're rebooting again here. We're having some lovely technical issues tonight. But we were talking about, we're moving on to talk a little bit about sound design, okay? So, I mean, the visual is probably the A+, but sound would be a close A to follow behind it, I would say, because you really need both. And it is something that I find that this particular director, Denis Villeneuve, is really good at. Like, he knows to do the 1-2 punch of making
very
sure.
Very atmospheric, very kind of a big part of the mood.
That's it. See, that's the best word to describe the sound to me, is atmospheric. Like, you are on Dune, you are on Caladan. They have sounds, they have a feel to them. And for me, and maybe it's because, like, I'm also part musician, that's kind of how I say it these days, but like, that's important to me, because sound landscapes is equally interesting to me as a visual landscape. Like, if you put something there, and it's a feast in this one. Like, there's just so many weird and odd little things that they do to make it better. All with, like, the thing that I like the best of it, though, Ed, is it's all done with the emptiness of space.
Yeah, you always feel that.
There's
definitely a
huge vacuum feel to everything. Which is how I feel that we all would feel if we were in interstellar, galactic, whatever. Like, that's how the best sci-fi is to me, that, like, when you're talking about this world-building things, it just makes everyone feel so small. You know what I mean? Mm. And that's the whole point. Even the sound design, because at times, especially when they are in space, it's empty. you know, it just can make you feel really, really kind of not there. Any specific sound points, though, like things that you liked about the sound that we haven't brought up?
Yes, definitely. The languages, the different languages that the different, you know, group speech, different. It evokes so much because it calls to certain cultures on Earth, you know, like the idea of, you know, Bedouin people or like Arab tribes and the cadence to some of the language of is what's the name of the planet?
Arrakeen's the capital. And the interesting thing is, not to ruin, it won't be ruined for you in the next film, but further on in the series you find out that the Fremen are actually from somewhere else as well. And that there's a deeper story. I can't remember the exacts of it. But I completely agree with you. Also because the book never speaks like it doesn't ever do a Lord of the Rings. Lord of the Rings is one of the only books I know that just literally goes into a foreign language and a foreign language it created, you know. And then I always love that, you know, the fact that J.R.R. Tolkien created Elvish, you know, the way he thought it should be written, blah blah blah. But this, like, I will completely agree. I thought, you know, the Sadarkar are described sometimes insufficiently in the books as really scary. They're just, you find out, you know, Seleucus Secundus, which they don't tell you in this one, I can't remember which book they tell you, is a prison planet. So these guys are all like convicts that are working off or never going to work off their sentences, but they are charged with like bleeding for the emperor, giving him that dark, giving them all this dark, menacing tone. Totally works. Like, I was total Warhammer 40k-ing it. I was like, yes, like this is exactly what they would sound like, and you would hate these people being on your planet. Like, you would just not enjoy it. But then I like the fact that they really leaned heavy on the Asian characteristics of Yui, which you know, that's not in the book at all. There's nothing to suggest that Dr. Yui is Asian. At least I shouldn't say Asian, like specifically one of the, you know, Chinese, Japanese, or Korean speaking countries. You know what I mean? Like, they definitely...
Played by Chang Chen.
I know. Such a great... And we're going to talk about that. That's next on the list is acting. But I liked it because it gives... In a visual medium like that, it gives... You know, some people really hated George Lucas for doing this in Star Wars, but I think sometimes when you do that, it helps give people perspective on the differences. You're not... It's not done in Dune in a way to make fun of accents or make fun of the way people are or culturally appropriate anything. It's done to explain that this universe we exist in Dune is massive and has lots of different lines of people. The other thing that's weird to me, Ed, and I don't remember if this connects back to Earth, you know, in the books. It might. I might have read it and forgotten that this all connects back. But if you notice, the year is 10, like 971. I'd never seen that before. Like, they don't, they set it out. Obviously, in the books, it's always the emperor's daughter, who you haven't met yet in the movie, that's kind of giving you the background, because she's eventually going to become Paul's wife, not to ruin everything for you. But, I mean, you should know that by now. Like, he wins, you know, and he's going to marry the emperor's daughter in the end. And she's the one that sets out the chronicles. That's her job, is to chronicle the history of Arrakis and everything else. And so everything you're told is from her perspective. And you never get this, like, connection back to Earth from that. Whereas in the movie, I felt a huge way. I thought that Denise was saying, this is just us in 10,000 years. You know what I mean? I really quite like that, because it feels that way in the book. You feel like these are advanced humans. These aren't like an alien race. Like, not like in Star Wars, where it could be completely... they don't have to be humans. It could be like someone else. These feel like an advanced version of humans. Someone that has continued the political, the economic, and the social and cultural norms that we had and put them 10,000 years into the future, you know?
Yeah, I don't know why. I kind of like the idea more that it is potentially like a distant other thing. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting. And so in the book, it's not like explicitly stated at all.
No, I mean, they give you years, but like then they don't, you know, there's an appendix and everything. Like, they don't tell you what those years pertain to, and everything's done by the counting of the emperor. It's why it's really funny that I told you, like, in Foundation, oh, it's the first time I've ever encountered that. It's not. The emperor that you know now is not the emperor that will become the emperor like in Foundation. And as I said, that's not ruining part two for you, because that happens way after part two. You know what I mean? But it's interesting to me because it's another way to set that up and just, you know, kind of talk about the history. There's a lot of that. There's like, reading the Dune appendix and like the opening bits by, because when she opens every chapter, the Empress is always writing like a quote from Paul Muad'Dib, which is called Paul. It's interesting. They changed it to Paul Mahdi, you know, in this one. And I don't know why it is. I can't wait to the behind the scenes to find out why was it Mahdi, not Muad'Dib. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know what the difference is, but you know, I'm sure it's cool. And she explains, like, he'll have a quip or a qualm or a clever thing or a piece in history. And he'll say, this happened in this era in history. That doesn't happen, you know, in the movie at all. And I'm glad they cut that because it would have just bogged the whole thing down. That's what I mean. They use sound design, Ed, to kind of cut across what they can't tell you about the history and say, these are all different people. You know what I mean? Like, they come from different places. They don't speak the same language. In fact, often they have to speak multiple languages to each other. So he's, to me, he's put us into, with the signs, sounds, and whatever, almost like a futuristic Lord of the Rings, where he's saying there are these different areas and different peoples, and they all talk a little bit different, you know?
Well, we talked a little bit about Game of Thrones and how, you know, maybe that helped pave the way a little bit for something like this with the, you know, different houses.
Yeah, like how do you do that in a visual medium? Where you still have to give immense props to Denis Villeneuve and his team are the fact that, you know, Game of Thrones is done over 8 seasons and people complained, you know, that's the conversations we have heard about why people didn't like it. Like, it should have gone on for another 2 after that, at least. Like, this, he had 2.5 hours.
A lot in with very little.
Yeah. Right. And the way he did that was the you know, the visuals part of it, but the sound design, I'd say, is the other thing that really helps establish you are not in Kansas anymore. These are not places that are familiar to you. These are, you know, institutions that have been around a long time, but you know nothing about. So pay attention, because
I have a question. Sure. Because it didn't bother me, but I did make a note of it while I was watching it. They battle a lot with like swords and spears and stuff like that. When obviously they have like, you know, missiles and laser technology and stuff like that.
Okay,
you know?
Good question.
Is that like a big part of? Because obviously they've got the technology with the slowing down of.
Yes. So this is something where, again, like the other thing I liked about the movie, and I'll say that, is like the movie is a great supplement to the book. And they haven't always been doing movies like that anymore. I mean, you know, Harry Potter, you started getting frustrated because in the beginning ones, it was like, well, why do I need to read the book? I just saw everything on the screen. You know what I mean? Yeah. Whereas it used to be that the book was always just had that bit much more information. You know, Lord of the Rings, similar to that, has more parts to it, unless you watch the extended versions. But we've kind of been getting away from having the book have more depth to it than the movie, because people want like movies with depth. Like, you can have both. And in this case, this is an instance of both, because the question Ed asks is clearly set out pretty early on in the books. And it has to do with the fact that, like, to get away from projectiles, they design these kinetic barriers. And so they all wear, every single person wears these kinetic shields. And they're just like, if you've ever played the game Mass Effect, they're very similar to the kinetic shields in that. At least the science fiction behind it. The idea is that a fast-moving object bounces right off of these things.
Right.
And so shooting someone would be completely pointless because a quick movement is blocked by the shield. However, because they're kinetic barriers and they have to have some practicality. In other words, like, I think the example that is given in Dune, it may not be in Dune, it may be somewhere else that is using this thing, but the example that I remember is, think about sitting on a chair. If you wore a kinetic shield as a suit and you needed to sit on a chair, the minute you went to sit down, the chair would fly across the room because it would go up against your kinetic barrier. So to make sure that you can practically do things like that, and again, it's not just sitting in the chair, it's these movements that you have to do as part of the battle and part of these things that you'll be doing. So slow moving kinetic energy does not trigger the shield, and that's why you see the red. So what they're trying, he tried to do it visually because everything is visual, and he tried to show you visually that if you see blue, it means that the knife is bouncing off the shield, and that's why they get so close to each other, because they can't throw it at each other and they can't even do a long slash. They have to be right up against each other. What they're waiting for, and I really like this, because this is why the fight scene with Duncan Idaho and with you know, Timothy Chalamet's character with Paul Atreides is so important, because what they're showing you there is how the system works, and that they have to get very close, and eventually one of them will get close enough to try to stick. Sorry, it's not Duncan Idaho, it's Gurney Halleck he has the fight with. But what
Josh, played by Josh Brolin in this
amazing
one,
we're,
played by Patrick Stewart in
the last one, right? And so the slow knife is what kills you. And there's a lot of phrases of that in the book that talks about that. But that's why they say that. Like, it comes up slowly and you have to do that. That's why when you later see Oscar Isaac's character, Duke Leto, get killed, it's because there's a hunter-seeker, that's what those little things were called, that slowly goes through his back, and he can't get to it in time, and it's slow enough that it pushes the barrier. You know what I mean? That it won't trigger the barrier. So that's why that is, but it's a really cool. good point.
It's
a good point to bring up. It's again why either you'd watch the film multiple times or you'll have to read the book for certain parts.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about that a little bit in story, which is a couple pegs down the way, because
yeah.
sound wise, I think do you have other things you wanted to ask with sound?
No. Beautiful. Like it's I'm good.
So, you know, A plus A for that. And then the A minus for me would come into the acting, which is powerful, but not what I wanted. And this was the hour long car ride with Ed, where you just had to listen. You know, I was talking about how I perceived these characters originally and how they came out. So again, I'd almost point it first to Ed to tell you about the acting generally, and then I'll sparse it in with maybe a couple of my little qualms, but please don't take those any more than a fanboy who absolutely loves Dune. Like, I've read this book six times. It's a 350 page book that I've read, you know, six times since I was 12. So that'll tell you how much I'm in love with everything that's in it, right? But for me, obviously, I had formulated in my head based on the previous movies and based on the things what these people should look like. So I'm going to step back for a second and say, Ed, tell him about the acting.
Okay. I'm going to go name by name, because this is quite a cast.
Oh, good man.
And there's a little bit of a mixed bag. So Timothy Chalamet, who plays Paul Atreides, I thought he did a fairly good job. I have not necessarily been following this guy's career, but he was in The King, which was a Netflix movie.
Yeah, it's the one with Robert Patterson as the other character, main like actor in that. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And he's going to be in The French Dispatch. He's just kind of the hotness right now. I thought he did a good job. I don't know how do you want to
Sure, I guess if we go character by character, we can talk about it. Like, listen, what I said to Ed is, like, the screen producer Jason loves Timothy. Is it Chalamet or Chalamet?
Chalamet.
Sorry, French last names, buddy. Birds of a feather there. Like, the screen loves him. The same reason I go on about certain women that I'm like, they just look good on camera. Like, they just look really good on camera. He looks good on camera. He's got the right facial structure for it. Every time the lines cut across, it was like, yeah, people would be drawn to that face. You know, even as young as he is. That was my qualm, is that he looked really young. But then if you go to the books, like, Paul is young in the books. That's the point. Like, you know, this is one of those, we were talking about, is it the story of the one? Like, kind of. It really kind of is. Like, it's written as if this child prodigy bit. And that filters into the rest of the books, too. So his descendants, his brethren and all that, like, it's all about them having a certain something before everyone else does. And that's what gives them power. So, you know, I think casting-wise, yeah, you know, for me, like you said, I still... Great on screen, but I didn't think the acting was amazing. Like, it just... I don't know if it could have been or it couldn't have been. There wasn't a point where I was like, wow, that's the Oscar scene right there. It was more, he adequately dealt with the things in front of him. I think the hardest thing for him to do as a character was to show why he should be the one, and he didn't deliver on that to me. I don't think... I think that's the hard thing, is that's why it doesn't work, because actors can't show you destiny. You know what I mean? Like, that's the problem you have with stuff like that, is like, why is he supposed to be? And The Matrix 1 works with that, because you give this guy these like superpowers, and then he's like, oh, this is why he's better than everyone else. But that's why it falls apart later, because you're like, but he isn't better than everybody else then. He has to die. What's going on here?
Well, this is where I'm wondering if they're going to go down the, you know, the one kind of storyline, or if they're going to try and subvert it somehow.
They might because
there were a couple of lines that he delivered which were like very much like, I don't want this, what if it's not me, like, you know, which could just lead you down the very simple...
story-wise, that's very much part of the book. So Paul Atreides is an interesting character, because even though he has this the one kind of thing, think of it more like, the one is always a reference to Messiah, to Jesus, so let's just go there. Mm. It's more Jesus in the garden. This is how, unfortunately, I know it, because I went to Catholic school my whole life. Like, and I love the character of Jesus. Now, I know that sounds horrible to Christians, but like, the character of Jesus? And I'm like, yes, the character of Jesus from the Bible, guys. Like, I'm sorry, that's how I look at it. Don't kill me. You know what I mean? But Jesus goes through these phases, right? And one of the phases that people were drawn to is Jesus after the Garden of Gethsemane. So that is when, you know, this is on his last days. He's about to die, 33 years old, about to go. And so, you know, he gets the Judas kiss. And then he goes to the mountain and he says, like, why? Like, why would you do this to me? Like, why? I don't care if I'm the Son of God. This doesn't make any sense. Why would you kill me? Like, I don't want to die. Because every person who's a human being would say that. That's the part of the story that's supposed to draw you back to his human qualities, that he doesn't want to die. I think that's written in the Dune the same way. Like, Paul Atreides does not want to be this guy who's going to bring on the war that will end everything. Sadly, Ed, like, because they made 9 of these books, like, he does. Like, he will. You know what I mean? And if, you know, Denis Villeneuve decides to take that in a different direction, I'm with you. I just think he'd have a really hard time doing that, because the entirety of the world shift that's going to happen is because of Paul. Right. And that's all Paul is saying, and that's why I like that they're doing it in two parts, because in the book it gets meshed. Like, because he quickly becomes this figure, like, you don't always understand that he was once a boy and then, like, his life was ruined by this happening to him, even though it looks like he's this all-powerful God now.
Right.
The movie's doing a better job of that, because it's saying, look how distraught this poor kid is. Like, he's learned the best.
That's where I will say that Chalamet does a very good job, is he's very good at being mopey and being like,
the problem I have, is I'm not sure if I liked his mopiness better than I like the one I consider like the original Paul Atreides, and the mental picture I have of Paul Atreides, which is the guy from, oh, he's in everything.
Twin Peaks,
Sex in the City. His name? I love him. McDougal is who he is in Sex in the City. But, is he McDougal in that or Desperate Housewives? Anyways, I love this guy because he's been in so many sitcoms, but shows that I've watched with my wife since then. But he has a different kind of moroseness to him in the David Lynch film. And it's more of a pondering. It is more like the books. In the books, it's more pondering. Like, he hates the terrible purpose, but it's all internal. He never really shouts at anyone about that, except Chani, like his, who becomes his girlfriend, obviously. He's always telling her, I don't want to be a part of this. But that's part of their relationship, is like, the only person he tells is her. Whereas in this one, I liked it because he goes to his own mother and he's like, why would you do this to me? Like, you don't understand what you've done. I hate this. Like, I see what's going to happen, because that is the character he's playing, the Kwisatz Haderach. And this goes a little bit of what we'll talk about with story, like, can travel through all space and time. He sees the future and the past as if it's happening to him now. Like, he just doesn't live in one particular area he moves. And you've seen that in other science fiction. It's very similar, that it just disorients the person. Like, it makes them feel like they're not real anymore, because they don't know if it's a memory, is it the future, or is it what they're in right now.
Okay, let me get back to this cast, because otherwise we're never going to finish this podcast.
Oh, I'm sorry, mate. Carry on, my friend.
So, Oscar Isaac as Duke Leto Atreides. I thought he was brilliant. I love him in everything. The only sad thing is that he didn't dance disco.
I love that scene in Ex Machina, you know, because I had to ask Ed, like, why did he do that? And you're like, because he's an amazing dancer. And I'm like, oh, he is. And I was like, oh, I want to dance with him now. You know what I mean? Like, he's just so talented. Yeah.
Did you like him as the Duke?
Oscar Isaacs, in my view, and it's not just because I look a little bit like him, you know what I mean, is one of my favorite actors in the industry right now. I would cast him as that kind of figure for anything. The father figure. The only problem I have with Oscar Isaacs, and it's maybe where I feel a bit, you know, like, I feel like personal to this, like, he's too old to do any of the young characters anymore. And so the only really action hero he got to play was Poe. And I'm like,
like, Moon Knight, fingers crossed.
That's right. So hopefully, because I just think this guy's got gravitas and he hasn't been used. You know, Ex Machina, if you want to know, like, the ultimate, and it came true, because, like, this was, at the time, it comes out, like, 2014, where they're throwing stones at Silicon Valley, and they're like, these guys are assholes and you don't know it. Like, you think these rich and powerful men are, like, the be-all and end-all, because in 2014 we did. And it's like, they point out, like, these guys are crazy, and they could go on because they don't have any filter. They don't have anyone telling them no. And Oscar Isaacs represents that, like, the epitome of that, you know, in Ex Machina. And so But you know, I liked him as Poe. I thought he was really good as Poe. I liked him as that. You're given what
it wasn't his fault. Let's be honest.
Exactly, you're given what you're given. Again, it's Natalie Portman in the first ones. Like, yeah, she does her best. Yeah. You know, even Eden. You know, was it Christian Hayden? I know
Hayden Christensen, which everyone's super excited for his return, by the way, because he's coming back in like Obi-Wan and in other stuff as well.
I guess so. Yeah, I mean,
yeah, weird.
Anyway, when I used to live around just white people, that was my looky-loo. Like, I used to love that. People were like, have you seen Life as a House? And I was like, I have. And they're like, you're just like Christian Hayden, whatever it is in there. And I watched the film and it was like, I don't really think I am, but okay. Like, he doesn't look anything like me. Sorry,
Josh
Ed.
Brolin as Gurney Halleck.
Just to explain, Ed's mad about this because he's heard all of this in the hour-long card ride we have on. Like, I'm not listening to another hour of this again.
It's like your fifth looky-loo. But anyway, Josh Brolin as Gurney Halleck.
Are you getting grumpy? Don't get grumpy.
No, not at all.
Okay. Josh Brolin, Thanos.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes. I thought a little bit wasted. I don't know why I expected... Was his character very reduced in the film?
No, that's the problem with Dune is you have lots of characters. And so many of them don't have a ton of time on the screen. Gurney had some scenes cut, like everything about Gurney. He had more in there than he did in the Lynch film, though. You know, in the Lynch film, there's really only like two scenes. The most underused one, because I think, and this was based, I think, on the actors, that they use less than it's used in the book, is Thufir Howitt. So, and then we can move on to that director when we get, or that actor when we get there. But no.
Yeah. Stephen McKinley Henderson.
So.
Played Thufir Howitt, the Mentat, of House Atreides.
Yeah. And I mean, I like the choice here. He clearly didn't have as much of the acting background as the others, but I do remember him from some things. And like, they kind of adjusted that appropriately, like, or maybe not appropriately, but to based on the fact that he hadn't acted as many things. Like, so there's a whole subplot in the book, Ed, between Jessica and Thufir. And it has to do with the fact that there's an allegation that the Bene Gesserit want to kill both Duke Leto and Paul Atreides. Like, they're going to lead to the end of the line. Because, and this is talked about, and I imagine this was done because the way the story plays out is like, well... That would have really confused things if you weren't sure whether the Bene Gesserit were actually going to kill Paul, because they're pretty clear that they're not. After he has the big encounter with them, they're pretty clear they're going to let him live. But if they said maybe they would, and that's what Thufir goes after Jessica, and she, you know, it's the lady Bene Gesserit against him, and he's always calling her a witch in the book. Those were all cut out, and I just think it would have been good, and I bet you they show up in the deleted scene somewhere, but... And again, it was one of those side stories that was fine to come out. The appearances that I saw with him were fine. You know what I mean? Like, it was good. I like the visual effects they added to make him different, you know?
Okay. Cool. Stellan Skarsgård as the Baron.
Perfect.
And Dave Bautista as Glossu Rabban.
Yes. So both playing really close to their characters in the book. Baron Harkonnen being, in my view, one of the hardest because he has all these physical deformities, and he's supposed to be just like a nasty, like, you think of him in the book as like this nasty, and you never really see him molest a child, I don't think, but this nasty child molester. That's what he comes across as, like a fat, overweight, disgusting child molester, you know? That's how he's portrayed. And David Lynch did a decent job of kind of doing that. He had this weird plug thing, and, you know, there were a couple things, but it didn't really come across other than you knew the guy was maniacal. This time, like, you feel the dread.
Yeah. 100%. Stellan Skarsgård kills it.
Well, and I told you, some of it was in the choice, too, in the production design, though. Like, what they do is they took away the other elements of Getty Prime, like the gambling, the social aspects of Getty Prime. They make it this dark, horrible planet. And I'm like, good. Like, that makes it easier to understand why the Atreides hate the Harkonnens. You've done, you know, to me, what you've done is you've done, like, you know, the Nazis versus the Americans, or the Nazis versus the rest of the Allies, you know, like, you've done a black and white where it's not so black and white in the book, but I think you had to. That way people get lost otherwise.
Then you had Charlotte Rampling. I didn't recognize her when I saw when we were watching it. But she plays the Reverend Mother of the Bene Gesserits, that has the, like, confrontation.
Brilliant.
Really good scene, right? That whole scene with Paul Atreides.
It's interesting, because I don't know whether that actress would complain She has much more prominence in the David Lynch version.
Okay.
Yeah, the Reverend Mother is a huge character in that one. Played also by a stellar actress. I can't remember who it is, but it's someone you would recognize and you would see the face and be like, yeah, I knew who that is. Mm-hmm. However, I like this one better. Because, again, the Reverend Mother is not a central character. She's an important character, and she's the head of the Bene Gesserit, or in the truthsayer to the Emperor. So, do you know what I mean? Both things which are infinitely important to understanding the world that you're dealing with. But she doesn't appear that often in the Dune, you know, the Dune books. And so, I like the fact that they shrouded her in mystery and kind of made her seem as dark and sinister as everything else. So, no, I was...
Do you know what I just found out, though? Like, before we got on mic, that I've been saving as a surprise.
Oh, here we go.
So they're doing a Dune Sisterhood TV spin-off.
Interesting.
Which is going to be about the Bene Gesserits. And it's like a little bit of a prequel. And Denis Villeneuve is directing the pilot.
Okay. Which
to me sounds amazing. I would totally watch it.
And the reason he's smiling ear to ear, we definitely had that conversation last night. Because Ed was like, well, what do you want from this? Because I just had gone crazy about how much I love Dune. And Ed had clearly realized like I was having a joygasm. So in my joygasm, I was like, well, I don't actually want them to make 10 of these. I want them to make like 3 to encapsulate the most important things about the Atreides story. But then I want them to do a Mando. I want them to expand the world and talk about all the rest of things. So yes, and more. This is exactly what I meant. Oh, like, oh, that's so good. Cool, thanks, right? Ed. That cheers me up. Not that I was depressed, but you know.
Jason Momoa as Duncan Idaho. I felt that he was a little bit wasted. I'm kind of hoping that there's going to be more of him in the second part.
Yeah, not at all. He was my favorite performance, I want to say, if I'm honest. Like, on my view, it was the first time you get to see Jason Momoa with a shave. And so, like, today I was walking into work with my shaven face, like, hey, guys. You seen Jason Momoa lately? You know, dark skinned guys with clean shaven. We're pretty cool, aren't we? Like, it was a good look for him. And he, like, this is the thing about casting Jason Momoa for an action role. Like, he brings what he needs to bring. Duncan Idaho is the, exactly as you saw it in the movie, like, he's the one that goes out to the front. And he's the Marine. He's the one in the front. And so, you know, as I said, if I remember correctly, like, I it was played by, like, this British guy in the David Lynch one who I don't even remember. And it was so forgettable. And I was pissed because I was like, Duncan Idaho is, like, one of Paul Atreides' favorite people in the whole wide world. You know what I mean? So, like, he needs to be someone that Paul can relate to, and I just thought that actually added so much by putting Jason into that role that you actually got more out of Duncan Idaho than you get in the book because it's played by someone who you could see in that character role, you know.
Yeah.
Very believable to me.
Okay, cool. Then you've got like the Fremen. You've got Sharon Duncan Brewster, who plays Dr. Liette Kynes, the ecologist.
Interesting, because that's a man in the I believe that's a man in the book.
Okay.
Maybe I can't remember. I thought it was a man, and he has a daughter that later stays. And I think they've combined the two into one character. Okay. But I will have to flip through the pages again to see if I'm right on that one. Because I always remember in my head Liette Kynes was this old man in my brain. Like when I saw him visually, it was a like an old white guy that had made friends with the Freeman. Kind of a Lawrence of Arabia style type person.
Because
that's his connection, is like he's one with the Freeman and he's actually willing to turn on them. The interesting change that they made with her is she is also the judge of change, which is a role that you don't really understand as well in the book as you do in the film, that like she's supposed to be there to make sure everything goes fair. Now, the book, like I told Ed last night, and we're probably going to have to skip the story section, the book does not like tell you outright what a trap it is. It's hinted and hinted and hinted and hinted. I like how the movie was like, fuck it, we're not going to hint this because you need to understand why it's so serious. Like, this is going to be... It was in the trailers. Like, that's what I loved about it. They said, this isn't a battle, this is a genocide. And that's what it is. Like, the whole point is the Harkonnens want to end the Atreides forever. It's not a battle. It's like, no, this was set up by the Emperor because he hates the Atreides, because he thinks, and it was called the Landsraad in the book, and they just call it the minor houses in the film, are going to take over. And so to exude his power some more, he gets the Harkonnens, one of the rival houses, to take them out. Like, that's poetry. That's Machiavellian, cool. You know? That's what it is.
Very Game of Thrones.
And that's what I mean. And Ronada Hubbard for whatever... Not Ronada Hubbard, sorry. Frank Herbert, not Ronada Hubbard. You know, I always confuse the two because I'm like, We listen to Ron Herbert, you know, we're listening to Frank Herbert talk about what Ron L. Hubbard was doing at this time, like creating religions to make people believe certain shit, right?
Yeah, yeah. You know, and that was a really cool element in the film.
And like something,
what they lead, because they leaned into.
And I think that's the French in him. He realizes what an important concept it is to the Dune series. So if you didn't understand it, or if you didn't grasp it from reading the books, like, you'll grasp it now. Frank Herbert hated religion. Hated it. Yeah. He saw it as, you know, as the communists did, an opiate of the masses, as something that is used for control. Now, why do I buy into that? Because if you listen to this podcast, I can tell you instances that religions were created for those reasons. Like, I was taught that in theology, that, you know, this religion was, these rules were created in this religion to keep these people from doing this. You know what I mean? Like, it does make perfect sense. In this case, he's setting up Paul Moadib, or Paul Mahdi, not as the one, but as the guy who's going to exploit the system so that he doesn't die. And I love that. Now, you may not have got that all from the part one, but that's what they were saying. Saying, like, the Bene Gesserit have been to Arrakis. They have set these weird myths in place hundreds and thousands, you know, hundreds or thousands of years ago. And now that's done so that when Jessica and Paul are on the lam, they go straight to the Fremen and extort this and say, like, oh, yes, this is who we are. We're these people. And because of that, they're saved. You know, it's that kind of stuff. Oh, man. Like, that's where Dune is at its best, man. Like, it's just showing you the larger landscape we're talking about. The wag the dog mentality that even 10,000 years in the future, we're still dealing with. You know, this kind of... And I think it's so appropriate for our times because this is what we're seeing. You know, it's the arguments people have about COVID. They're saying Boris Johnson doesn't tell the truth. He can't ever give bad news. Well, guess what, guys? In a galactic empire 10,000 years in the future, shit's the same way. You know, like... So...
Yeah. Javier Bardem was a lovely little surprise. I'd forgotten that he was in it.
Yeah, you'll see, like, more of him. Stilgar is an important character. You'll see more of him. Yeah.
And then we kind of get to the maybe not so great points. Zendaya as Chani, the young Fremen girl, and Rebecca Ferguson as Lady Jessica.
Ooh, and Paul's
mother.
Are you sitting on both of those as well? It's kind of like you weren't as impressed with Lady Jessica?
I was disappointed that Zendaya's, like, all over the trailer, and she's a big name, and she's barely in it for, like, 5 minutes.
Yeah, like...
But it was such a nice surprise that there's going to be a second part, that my assumption is that 90% of her stuff is going to be in the second.
Yeah, no, and she's, you know, crucial moving forward. So obviously she hasn't married or done anything with Paul. I don't know if she ever marries Paul. I can't remember. But
the one that I didn't really have any problem with was Rebecca Ferguson. But you kind of had some thoughts because of your, like, expectation and
history. That's what I mean. Like, that's why I don't mean to put her at the bottom, because she is, like, no, she's a very talented actress. That's not, like, that's why I feel, because we're talking about acting, it's like, how well do they act? Like, she did fine. Like, the problem was the choice of her as the character. Like, what I told Ed is, like, listen, the Lady Jessica is a decision made by Duke Leto to take on as his concubine instead of marrying, because he's so in love with this woman. And, like, I just didn't get that. And the other...
They didn't really do... There was, like, a throwaway line where he says to her, like, I should have married you.
Yeah, and like...
that confused me. It took you explaining that to me.
Again, since we're not going to get to... We're almost at an hour and a half, guys, so I'm going to cut us off, you know, without going to 2 hours on this one. But in the story, in the book, this is where you'll get more from the book. In the book, there are loads more scenes with them in the bedroom. It's all pillow talk. And it's important because you realize... that Duke Leto, even though he's the strong kind of commanding character, has this immense soft side. And that's the whole reason he's with Jessica, is because she knows this. And, like, you know, it's lovers, you know what I mean? It's what lovers are, you know, to each other. And so I just felt like, again, it's production decisions, and I'm sure they had good reason. But A, between the casting and the lack of those scenes, you don't get that connection between Leto and Jessica that you had before. Because when he dies or he's taken, like, it's so much of a bigger deal for her in the movie. Or in the book, sorry, than the movie. In the movie, I was wondering, like, does she even really care? Like,
you do get a little vibe of that.
You know what I mean? Is her Bene Gesserit stuff carrying in, and she just cares about taking care of Paul? Because the other thing is, and maybe this is... Okay, now I'm getting to where maybe they had to make a production decision. The contrast in the book, the thing that doesn't always make sense, is in the book, she kind of knows he's going to die because the Reverend Mother says that. She's like, for the father, the line that's, and it's in the David Lynch movie, for the father nothing, maybe we can save the boy. That's what she tells Jessica after that Gom Jabbar meeting. You know, after the meeting where he sticks the hands in, she's like, okay, he impressed me. I've never seen anyone do that before. So I can try to save him, but you know, Duke Leto is going to be going. And again, because that scene never happens, like, she bawls at that. Obviously, she pleads and she says, Reverend Mother, like, that's not fair. Like, you can nothing be given to Leto? Can we not? Like, I love him. And she's like, it was your choice. You knew this was going to happen. Like, you always knew this was going to come to a bad end. So don't pretend like, you know, like you didn't see the writing on the wall. And so that just doesn't enter into the movie at all. And I was like, okay. I was like, I guess. But then, like, her character, again, Sean Young plays it and the David Lynch version. And I would encourage you, Ed, not just for your male fantasy moments, but, you know, she's really done up in that. It's one of Sean Young's best, you know, again, done up Blade Runner style, where she just looks phenomenal in it. You know what I mean? And then obviously in the book, she is described as this woman that commands people's attention. This sounds horrible because I'm not trying to be a misogynist here at all. I'm just trying to say, to me, that's like a Charlize Theron. You know what I mean? That's a woman you put on screen and everybody's eyes turn to her. You know what I mean? Or even, you know, Margot Robbie's another one like that right now, that everybody kind of looks at the screen. I'm not saying you have to have a blonde with blue eyes. I'm just saying, like, I didn't get that from her. Like, I didn't get it at all from her. I was like, why does she command presence? Like, she doesn't look like she commands presence to me. Like, and that's horrible because you did your best at the acting. It was just, that's not the role I would have put you in. You know what I mean? I just don't think it fits. Total casting decision, whatever. She delivers what she had, you know, the lines she has. She delivers them well and moves on well, but that was my qualms. And Zendaya was much like you said. The problem with that, to me, was it was more modeling than acting. Like, lots of great shots with her smiling at the screen, looking like a commercial. And this is not talking about your acting. I know you're a good actress. That's why I was surprised. And then I did, you know, I made the shitty qualm, and please don't ever listen to my podcast because you'll never be friends with me. But she sounded Peter Parker to me. I like the 10 lines she had to me sounded like I was watching, you know, Far From Home again. And I'm like, wait, no, like, he's not a nerd. Like, he's not, he may look weird to you, but he's a complete foreigner. And again, it's expectations, isn't it, Ed? So the reason I'm railing about this is because there's so many scenes in the book where she's like, tell me about where you come from. And she's like, she's in love with him, like, but she doesn't know why. And he's in love with her and they don't know why. And it's like, that's why it works so well. I didn't get the impression at all that she cared. Like, the way she looked at him, I was like, I'm not quite sure you're keen on the dude. So maybe we've just modernized. Maybe it's like, well, you know.
It was very throwing shade.
Screw this. Screw this women swooning for people they would never swoon for. You know what I mean? We're just going to make her skeptical until she sees it delivered, you know?
Yeah.
So that's the whole cast, isn't it, man? Aside from the bit parts, which, again, shout out. And this isn't like they do a multiracial, multicultural cast without it feeling like checkboxing. So well.
Yeah.
The last time I saw it done that well was 300. 300 is one of these films that, believe it or not, even though they had Greeks all over that film, and there's no Greeks in the film, I'm very sorry, but, you know, they definitely had a diversified cast because they had the Persians, and so they made sure that they could kind of filter it around more. And that's how it felt. Like, and I'm remembering, like, the Herald reminded me very much of the Herald from 300 on that one, but just setting up other people's, other cultures within, you know, everything. Even, you know, the House Atreides didn't have to be just all white people, you know what I mean? And and the Harkonnens had well, just weird looking people, you know what I mean? They were aliens.
Yeah.
So, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I like that. It's like, okay, here we are expanding our horizons. The only thing I would have said in there, I would have put the, you know, if it was me directing Dune, which, you know, you did ask me years ago, is there a book you'd want to direct? Yeah, after watching this, I'm like, yeah, I'd love to direct Dune. Like, I could probably put a good version together. But I might have changed the race of the character. The main character. I might have, especially with Oscar Isaacs, you had a real opportunity there to put a Latino into Paul's character. Maybe I'm just mad that I wasn't cast for that role. But you know what I mean? Like, it could have been a good opportunity to make it a not white guy that's going to save the world. But, you know.
Yeah.
What with Timothy Chalamet?
Yeah, right.
Do you know what I mean? Like, exactly. Like, I hate to say it like that because it's not.
M. Night ruined it for all of us.
No, it's just like, because you feel bad saying that because there's nothing wrong with that. It's just, we are crying for different things now. We just kind of want to see it. Like, if you can make it different, please. You know what I mean? Like, okay.
Yeah.
But the acting is strong, you know, acting, sound, visual. Story, yeah. Story follows the book, guys. That's what I'll say. The only thing I can say about story in 10 seconds, because we're out of time, listen, this is something you can watch, and then if you want more, read the book.
Yeah, definitely. It kind of entices you to do that. And I think they did a very good job of, like, splitting a story over two parts is often harder than doing it over three parts.
Oh yeah,
because of the three acts.
The Hobbit, right? They couldn't get it done. Remember, they Guillermo del Toro wanted a two-parter, and they were like, "Nope, no work.
Yeah,
you can't do it that way."
So I think they did a great job of making it satisfying enough as a standalone film. But I'm super excited for part two. The weird thing is, it does seem like it wasn't a guaranteed thing, which to me seems crazy. But I guess, you know, it's the gamble, right?
Well, could you do that? So if this bombs at the theaters, which I don't think it will, they're still waiting for international box office to kind of make it worthwhile for the sequel. But yeah. if this doesn't do as what they expected and they don't make a second Dune, like, could I handle this as just one glimpse of that world? Yeah. Give me the second part in like 10 years. You know what I mean? Let me have that in my late 40s. You know what I mean? Mm. And then I'll make a hell of a good version of it that follows from this one. But, you know, the way they did that, Ed, that ending scene where they're all going into the siege, like, it does work for me as a natural ending point, being like, yeah. Paul is saved. They're going to go on to something else. If you want to know what happens to Paul, pick up the book.
Yeah.
Works for me. It works really well for me. So, you know what I mean? That's story. We were going to talk about adaptation. I don't have enough time. That's what it is. It's about choosing which scenes to keep and which to peel out. I'm complete. Like, I wouldn't have picked the same scenes in, the same scenes out, the exact same ones. But largely, I can totally see where he was coming from with it and, like, loved it. And was like, yes, he kept it. I would say the changes from the book is he kept it simple. Okay? Yeah. Like, there's a lot of things that have more depth and are a lot grayer in the book than they are in the movie. But when you have a visual medium, you can't always make things gray, because all of a sudden people are like, well, I'm not sure what I'm watching now. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So story 100%. Was excellent. And I think that's all the categories, right?
I can't remember the categories.
Yeah, it's been so long,
it's
man.
It's a long time.
Back 100th episode, right, guys? You know, 99 episodes ago. Have you ever gone back and listened to the first episode, Ed?
Not since we recorded, I don't think, no.
It's really funny. I think I listened like the first 10 minutes of it and was like, man, it's not terrible, but it's like
terrible,
we haven't set anything up yet.
Watching the early Dirty 20s.
Dude, oh, I remember it was like 30 minutes. Like, that was the other thing. We were doing the first episode of because we started by doing His Dark Materials. I think. Because we didn't do the Mando till later. Yeah, His Dark Materials, and the entirety of the episode one was only 30 minutes. And I think it's maybe because I was like, we have to keep them short, Ed. And I was like, how did we ever manage to talk about an entire episode of His Dark Materials in 30 minutes? Like,
don't ask me.
You know what I mean? And that was with the intro and the brass tacks. I still had done all that stuff. So I was like, Jesus Christ, Jason. Like, that's why I only listened to 10 minutes. Because I was like, oh, this can't be good. I'm just going to stop at some point and be mad at myself that I didn't talk more about the episode. But on that point, at an hour 36, I'm going to stop myself now and say, listen, I've not got much more to say about Dune except go watch it. You know what I mean? Go out there, go watch it. If you're an indie filmmaker,
go to the theater, please, please, please.
Oh yeah, do not wait for this one. You know, this is the other shit, right? Because Warner Brothers, isn't Warner Brothers releasing this at the same time? Isn't this one that was up?
It's HBO.
Yeah, HBO Max is releasing this. That they got in a lot of trouble with Legendary over this. Don't, okay? Don't watch on HBO Max. Go to the cinema. This is a cinema film, not a TV at home film. And you can watch in the cinema, and then when you watch the TV at home, you'll be fine, because you'll be like, I remember all this. But that's, you've got to create that memory, man. Otherwise, it's just not going to have the same effect.
Yeah.
But that's all from me. Go out and watch it. Be good. Happy 100th episode, everybody.
Yes, happy 100th.
Anything more from you, my good man?
No. I think that covers it.
Excellent. All right. Well, we will catch you all next time. I have no idea what we'll be doing next. We do have a lot of stuff coming up. We have Ghostbusters coming out in November. We have One Night in Soho, end of October. Matrix is coming out. The Eternals are coming out. All of those are likely to get a podcast because Ed saw all the trailers now. And I was like, yes. So keep watching the space. I'm still pulling people in to be on the podcast. We went through a period where everybody wanted to be on the podcast. And now all the people that want to be on the podcast, nobody wants to be on the podcast. So if you want to be on the podcast, let me know. If you don't, it's no big deal. We don't mind. Like, I don't take it personally at all. I just, you know, I miss you. But anyways, hope everybody has a good week moving forward. And we will catch up with you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.